thanks to the partners of this council, University of Lethbridge, and our television friends, many people, Lethbridge Herald, many people will be hearing this presentation today. Our procedures, as you know, is to offer the speaker this podium for 25 minutes, after which lunch is served. Questions are discussed and will be presented in the forum part of the meeting, which follows the lunch. The cost of the lunch is $8. Someone will be around with a basket to squeeze the money from you, and you're obliged to put it in, whether you eat or not. The business is that you pay for the speaker. If you don't like the speaker, you pay anyway. If you don't like the lunch, you pay anyway. You're not getting out without, you know, we need $8. How do you think we live? All right. So we need that $8, and someone will come around and pick it up. And now we have the pleasure today to hear from Professor Gordon Laxer, who dove down with his lovely wife from Edmonton. And I'd like to recognize her because she's part of the feast today that we're going to have. Judith, will you stand up? Judith Laxer from get recognized. And we thank you for coming too, Judith. We thank you both for coming. Gordon is delinquent in coming here, and we chastise him in this introduction. It's been 12 years since he's been here, and that won't do. We want him back here much more frequently than that, as you will hear at the end of a presentation to that. But we rejoice that he's here with us today. Gord has been a socially engaged public intellectual for many years, who's been involved in the issues of economic sovereignty for years, and social activism, public activism. He was the first chair of the Waffle Movement in Canada, for example, in 1969. And as a part of the Laxer name, your brother, what's his name?
James.
Pardon?
James.
James and Gordon have written plenty and have spoken, as you will hear today, plenty at various tribunals and high places. He is the author of many books and articles, and is I have some pleasure to tell you that he is the co-founder and director currently of the Parklands Institute. The Parklands Institute is a special breed of cat, as he will probably tell you. It is lodged within the Faculty of Arts in the University of Alberta. It operates within the established traditions of the university, and is considered an outstanding agency for publication, research, books, articles, conferences, speakers, questionnaires of all kinds. And we've had others from the staff of the Parklands Institute. So, Gord, it's an immense pleasure to welcome you back as a friend. I had the honor to be, for a short time, a member of the board of the Parklands Institute, and so came to appreciate the quality of his work and thinking and staff. And we welcome him here with great pleasure, and ask you to speak for 20 to 25 minutes, Gord, and then we'll have at you in the question period.
Some water there. Yeah, I do. Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here again. It has been too long. I suppose I've been remiss. I promise to come more frequently if you invite me. You'll have to see after today's talk. yes. How many of you are familiar with Parkland Institute? Most of you. How many are on our membership or email list? Really, that's very good. In a few minutes, we're going to actually pass around, if anybody wants more information about Parkland Institute, we will pass it around and hope that you join with us with that. Is the PowerPoint working? Wow, wonderful. Okay, well, the last few days have been quite interesting. How do you know about the story of what happened in the Parliamentary Committee a week ago?
Yes,
I will tell you. I was invited to be an expert witness formally to a Parliamentary Committee on International Trade, to look at the Security and Prosperity Partnership. Now, this Security and Prosperity Partnership, the corporations and the government have been talking about this plan really for since a few weeks after September 11th. But they didn't want Canadians to find out about this, or the public to find out about this. The process was formalized in Waco, Texas, in March 2005, when the Prime Minister of Canada and the Presidents of the U.S. and Mexico got together. I call it the WACO Texas process. Basically, the idea, and this, the Canadian Council of Chief Executives came out with this strategy right after September 11th. And you have to realize that, you know, when they talk about the Canadian corporate community, half of these people represent foreign-owned corporations, and they get their marching orders from headquarters. So, you know, Imperial gets it does almost nothing without getting approval from Exxon. So the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, they decided, well, the Americans are really getting hepped up about the border and security, and they may close the border, and there was a few days when the border was closed. So this became the agenda of the corporations in Canada. Canada must go along with the American security agenda as they define it. And if we do that, then we will be able to get our exports into the American markets, and it will not be hurt. So that means basically that Canada must adopt the U.S. immigration and refugee laws, versions of its Patriot Act, go along with its military, go along with its energy policy, and that's what I'm going to be talking about here. And water is also an issue, as we found out. Well, these talks have been going on amongst officials, and they haven't told the publics, you know, in any of the three countries that this is happening. And they didn't for a very good reason. You remember the great free trade debate we had in the late 1980s. Well, a lot of Canadians didn't like that, didn't like the free trade agreement. And so the more they learned about it, the more Canadians disliked it. And there is worry that this will happen again. I consider that if we go right down the road of this Security and Prosperity Partnership, as they call it, that will be almost like annexation without sending the senators to Washington. You know, it's an absorption. They call it harmonization, which, you know, is a beautiful word. But I can't see the Americans adopting Canadian or Mexican practices on anything. You know what harmonization means. It means they call the tune and we sing harmony. So, what happened? Peter Julian, the NDP member from Burnaby, who was a member of the International Trade Committee, the Parliamentary Committee, demanded that the committee look at this strategic and the SPP. And so they started to bring in witnesses. So they've done it four times. And they would bring in two witnesses who were pro-SPP and two who were opposed. And I was one of those who was brought in officially as on the opposition side. So this happened on May the 10th. The first hour, they heard from government officials who sounded just like they were from the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, giving exactly the same position. These were government officials, bureaucrats. And then it went to the opponents like me. So I started off. Leon Benoit was the chair of the committee. And he said, we had 8 minutes to make my presentation. I get in to about three and a half, 4 minutes. I mean, my first paragraph was, I don't understand why Canada is discussing helping to ensure American energy security when Canada has no energy policy and no plans or enough pipelines to get oil to Eastern Canadians during an international supply crisis. And then I could see the Conservative members of Parliament caucusing, not listening to what, and then the chair just said it halfway through my talk, this is off topic, and I am ordering you to stop testimony. Then the Peter Julian put up his hand and said, "I challenge the chair." And the majority of members of the committee, who were opposition parties, the Liberals and the Bloc, joined the NDP, and they overturned the ruling of the chair. So Mr. Benoit threw down his pen and said, "The meeting is adjourned," and stomped out of the meeting. Then the Liberal vice chair took the chair's position and carried on the meeting and asked me to apologize and asked me to continue on with my testimony. In any case, it sounds like I was, you know, I don't know the motivation of Mr. Benoit, but it sounds like I was getting a bit too close to the bone talking about energy. Well, what I'm talking about today is whether Canada is an energy emerging energy superpower or whether it is more a resource satellite of the United States. Did that turn? Did that change?
Press the down.
Yeah, but it so that
can I direct it to
there. Is it changed? No. I could signal you.
Yes, okay.
The next one. Tory's storm out of meeting. Is that on?
No.
Well, I'll carry on anyways. We only got a few minutes. The Canada has promised to ensure. Oh, that's good. Okay, if you could switch to the next one as well. Canada promises oil security for U.S. So Prime Minister Harper said George W. Bush can count on a secure flow of oil and gas from its biggest energy supplier and trading partner, Canada. And the former Premier Klein was down in Washington. This was a year ago, again, making similar promises. You've heard the phrase that... Canada is an emerging energy superpower. Let's go to the next one. Is that no energy security plan for Canada? Yeah. Well, the National Energy Board, as you know, is in Calgary. They have a mandate to promote safety and security in the Canadian public interest. I wrote them and I a month ago, and I asked them. I said, "What have you done any studies on security of supply for Canadians?" And this is the first line of what they wrote back me in their email. The NEB has not undertaken any studies in security of supply. You know, I wonder what this is supposed to be Canadian government, what they're supposed to be looking after Canadians. I don't understand this. What I say, you know, we remember the debate about the old National Energy Program. It had some good goals, Canadianization, raising self-sufficiency. Those were good things, but the unilateral way that was done, the anti-Alberta part of it, was certainly not good. But we now have a new NEP, no energy plan. And this is even worse than the old one. Next slide. Is it emerging energy superpower? Well, the Prime Minister brags that Canada is a new emerging energy superpower and secure source of almost limitless energy resources. Well, I just want to examine this for a minute. Is this right? Well, when I looked up what a superpower is in the dictionary, superpowers can influence events by projecting economic, military, political, and cultural power on a world scale. So does that fit Canada? On the other hand, is it a satellite? Well, what's a satellite? Satellites are formerly independent countries dominated through deep ideological allegiance and economic dependence on a more powerful country. Next slide, please. Well, okay, well, let's look at how much independence energy policy Canada has. With NAFTA, Canada lost control over its energy exports, so I don't know how many of you know this. Most Canadians do not. We are obligated to export the same proportion, the same share of energy. This is oil, gas, electricity, whatever form of energy, as we have in the last 3 years, even if we're short in Canada. So we are now exporting 63% of our oil and 56% of our natural gas to the United States. And meanwhile, on the other side, we're importing a lot of oil. So we lost control also. When you lose control over how much you produce, then you lose control over the emissions of greenhouse gases. Because what if we wanted to say, hey, instead of building another tar sands plant, why don't we cut consumption by that same amount? Well, if we did that with proportionality, all the energy savings we'd be making, we would be just exporting the extra to the U.S. So, you know, are Canadians going to drive smart cars so that more Americans can drive SUVs and Hummers? So then there's the question of security of supply to Eastern Canadians, which I'm going to go into. There's foreign ownership and control that we gave up as well, because NAFTA says the Canadian government cannot protect Canadian ownership. And, of course, we cannot control the price at which we buy back our own oil from the transnationals who control it. A satellite or a neocolony are those that lose control, and in this case, over energy and our environmental future. Next, please. Alberta. Well, Alberta is very much part of this new NEP, No Energy Plan, guaranteeing the U.S. unlimited access to Canadian oil and gas, defying the Kyoto Convention. I'm embarrassed to be an Albertan on this issue. The 1% royalty rate. As you know, Alberta gets a 1% royalty rate, a gross royalty rate on tar sands, until the capital costs are paid off. That can be as low as 25 cents a barrel. The extent, if you compare, and I've got a later slide in this, but I'll say it now. Norway started their fund, their petroleum fund, 10 years ago. They have almost $300 billion in it now. They have about the same amount of oil and gas as Alberta. We have $14 or $15 billion in our heritage fund. We started it in 1976, 30 years ago. That is the extent to which, and in Norway, the Shell and Exxon and all those companies still operate in Norway under much, and they have high cost production off in the North Sea as well. Here is a quote. We found this from the Fraser Institute, was doing some promotion and fundraising, and they quote Premier Klein, "In all my years as Premier of Alberta, I have never once heard anyone articulate a compelling vision of Canada's continental energy future." And this is what our former Premier is now set out for himself to do for the Fraser Institute, along with Brian Tobin, the former Premier of Newfoundland. The SPP, the next one. What about the SPP in terms of energy? Well, it was interesting that on January 24th, 2006, the U.S. demanded that Canada raise the tar sands production to 5 million barrels a day. There was a secret meeting between officials in Canada. Does anybody know the significance of that date? What?
The election.
That's right. This is the day after the Harper government was elected. And the next day, they are sort of getting orders about what to do. And, of course, most of these, the tar sands oil, is exported to the U.S. is already 75% of that oil. So if we want to know why the environment of one quarter of Alberta, it's an area bigger than the three maritime provinces, is where this is tar sands, oil sands. This is an environmental disaster. And, of course, the other strategy is to call it a North American energy security plan. The Americans have an NEP, and it is called an NEP, a National Energy Policy, started in 2001. Dick Cheney headed up that committee. And guess what it calls for? Energy self-sufficiency for the United States, energy independence, and American ownership of the oil companies. If you remember, a year or two ago, they stopped the Chinese buyout, attempted buyout of Unocal. So it sounds very much like the old Canadianization aims of our national energy program. Well, they have their own national plan, but they want Canada and Mexico to get involved in this North American one because we're both net exporting countries and they're importing countries. Another part of what they want us to do is to build liquefied, that LNG means liquefied natural gas, terminals in Canada and Mexico to export to the U.S. Why? Because there is a lot of objection in the United States for environmental reasons to put them in the U.S. So, for example, they're building Irving is building a LNG terminal in St. John, New Brunswick, and all of this natural gas is going to go to the U.S. And there's plans for others. They also want to ease environmental regulations, and it was in part of the last federal budget in March. They said they're going to reduce from 4 years to 2 years the regulatory process. So I think the big oil companies see the writing on the wall with concerns with climate change, that they want to get as many of these projects approved as quickly as possible, get underway so it's very hard to stop them. And they're also talking about bringing in temporary Mexican workers to work in Alberta without the rights of permanent residents, without immigrant rights, meaning the right, they don't have the rights to stay here. It's like the so-called guest workers in Europe who have absolutely no rights. None of us are opposed to bringing in foreign workers, but they should have total, full immigrant rights, human rights. Next one. Well, I was going to talk a bit about the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline. I'm going to skip over this part quickly, but we are running out of natural gas. We only have 8.7 years of proven supply. Natural gas is the main energy source in the tar sands, so they have to use it to heat up the oil. And, of course, they also take the hydrogen from it for upgrading. Next one, please. Canada does have a lot of oil. We have a lot of oil in the tar sands, but we don't have very much natural gas, actually. We only have 1% of the world's natural gas. So why we're exporting more than half of it, I don't know. Before the free trade agreement, Canada used to have a rule that we cannot export. The National Energy Board had this policy. You cannot export until we have 25 years of proven supply of oil and natural gas before we... And Alberta had a rule that, and it was brought in by Social Credit in 1951, that we don't export unless we have 30 years of supply of natural gas anywhere beyond Alberta's borders. This was a good principle. The tar sands is going to be using, and over projected over the next 12 years, to use 12 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. We only have 54 trillion cubic feet. We're obliged to export 43 trillion. I was trying to look at what the Canadian demand for natural gas was. I couldn't find that right away, but you can see it doesn't add up. We don't have enough natural gas to be doing all of these things. We're supposed to be setting aside, now it's down to 15 years of usage in Alberta before exporting. And, of course, this contributes tremendously to greenhouse gases. And Canada is supposed to cut greenhouse gases by 40% from the BAUs, which is business as usual, rise by 2010. Next, please. Natural gas in the tar sands. There's a tremendous amount of natural gas used, 750 cubic feet of natural gas to produce one barrel of oil. 1,500, that's the deeper stuff, and the majority of tar sands is actually the deeper stuff, the in situ. 1,500 cubic feet of natural gas can heat Canadian home in the winter for 8 days. That's how much natural gas is being used to produce one barrel of oil. One barrel of oil is about a bathtub worth of oil. That's 153 liters. By 2012, the tar sands will need 2 billion cubic feet a day, which is enough to heat all Canadian homes for a day. And this is 1.5 times the amount that the tar sands is going to need, 1.5 times the gas from the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline. Next, please. Greenhouse gases and exports. Well, the tar sands are the largest single GHG source, 23 million tons in 2000, projected to go up between doubling and quadrupling. And the greenhouse intensity is almost 3 times as great as for conventional oil. So in Alberta, you see conventional oil is going down. The tar sands oil is going up. So that means that the greenhouse gases are going to be rising when, in fact, we've got to be cutting them drastically. And, of course, we use also 2 to 5 barrels of water for every barrel of oil. Next, please. Have you heard of nuclear as the green alternative? This is going to be the great new debate. There's a lot of uranium in northern Saskatchewan. They're building a road from La Loche to Fort McMurray. And they're touting this. First of all, it is not carbon neutral. It takes a lot of fossil fuels to refine uranium, so there is production of greenhouse gases in that. Although it is fewer, it's lower in fossil use, but they've never figured out what to do with the waste. And that is a problem. It takes something like 1,000 years to break down or more. And they never figured out what to do about accidents. Next one, tar sands moratorium. Parkland Institute and a number of other groups in Alberta have been calling for a moratorium on new tar sands plants. And this is actually not a very radical call, because we're saying anything, this is just new projects, anything that's already under construction, we're not calling for that to be closed. And with the current projections, the current construction, it will more than double the amount of tar sands production, even just with the current construction. It will go up from 1.2 million barrels a day now to between 2.5 and 3 million barrels a day. And we're saying until you should give no new approvals until you meet strict environmental regulations. Deposits for land reclamation, don't leave those toxic ponds for us, the public, to clean up. No subsidies for production of dirty energy. And you can bring in other clauses as well. There should be no approvals unless they upgrade in Alberta and in Canada. No exporting of raw bitumen. Make sure you don't have the greenhouse gases, all of those things. Next one. Insecurity for Eastern Canadians. We import 850,000 barrels a day. 45% come from OPEC countries. So here we're doing all these exports. Meanwhile, the Atlantic Canada and Quebec are relying 90% on foreign oil, and Ontario now 40%. The big three importers from Canadian importers from... I had to really look for this information. No one has been talking about this. No one. From Algeria, Saudi Arabia, and Iraq. Now, how secure is that oil? We have, the other thing that's really interesting is that we have no strategic petroleum reserve. Canada is a member of the International Energy Agency. There are 24 countries. The IEA was set up in 1974 to counter OPEC and its boycotting power. And the idea, every country, a member, must have 90 days of supply on hand in case there is an international supply crisis. But if you're an exporting country, a net exporting country, you don't have to do it, because the International Energy Agency assumes you're going to supply your own market first, and therefore you don't need a strategic petroleum reserve. So if you look at the net exporters in the IEA, there's only 4 of them. Britain and Denmark have petroleum reserves because they're members of the European Union, also who must have it for that reason. Norway doesn't have it, but it supplies its own market first, sensibly. So here we are. We are as open to and vulnerable as the United States is, and they think that that's a problem, but the Canadian government is not doing anything about this. As far as I can see, no plans, no studies, and they don't want anybody to talk about this. I don't understand it. I mean, in which NAFTA country are the... people most likely to freeze in the dark. Okay, let's skip. I've got slides on dwindling oil supplies. Let's go through that. Foreign ownership is high. Imperial Oil. Let's just stop on Canada's oil and the U.S. military machine. Canada is the number one exporter of oil to the United States. We surpass Saudi Arabia. And of course, we supply about 15% of the natural gas. And the Pentagon is the world's largest buyer of oil. So Canada is then a major fueler of the U.S. war machine. Okay, the next one, government control over oil and gas. The interesting thing, we keep hearing about, you know, let's not put up high royalties or environmental regulation, or maybe the whole oil industry will shut down, they won't invest here. Well, the interesting thing is that the oil industry has almost nowhere to go. 80%, well, this was from Dick Cheney. Governments and the national oil companies are obviously in control of about 90% of the assets. Oil remains fundamentally a government business. Yeah, there are not many things that Dick Cheney and I agree on, but I will agree at least on that one. I'd like to see a crown, an Alberta crown public oil company. Yes. Okay. Let's skip the next two, the lack of investment opportunities, the new Seven Sisters of Oil, the Keystone Pipeline. Let's see if we can get to green and sovereign alternatives. Okay, are we on to that? Well, exiting NAFTA's proportionality clause, capping and slowing tar sands production alternative vision. Well, we can, let's go to the next one, exiting NAFTA proportionality clause. This, as I say, is an obstacle to the green policy. It's going to be hard to convince Canadians to drastically cut, and we can get out of NAFTA. Let's go to the next one. The Americans have been saying since September 11th that security now trumps trade. Well, by that logic, security for Canadians trumps NAFTA. Next one. Exiting proportionality. Mexico is not subject to this proportionality clause. They said, no way, we're not going to sign that. And so they're a member of NAFTA, so I think we should demand, and we should be out there and getting people to demand a Mexican exemption. Now, actually, the Canadians voted in the 1993 election when they supported Chrétien. Chrétien, the part of the Liberal government policy was to get this same Mexican provisions. He got this mandate. He goes to Clinton. Clinton says no. And Chrétien comes back and says, okay. And then we never hear about it again. But we've got to do this. And if the United States won't give us a Mexican exemption, and I, in fact, very much doubt that they would, any party can exit in 6 months. NAFTA is broken anyways. The Americans broke it in August of 2005 when they ignored the softwood lumber, the extraordinary panel decision. And I think if one party ignores the decision, the other parties are not bound by it either. We should ignore the NAFTA provisions. What's the use of an agreement when the Americans only follow when they win and they don't follow it when we win? Finally, comparing energy resources, you see that. Then there is public ownership, social ownership. I'm almost finished here, Gordon. The national oil company, are we on public ownership, social ownership? Controls 77% of the world's reserves. Public ownership, the advantage is they have location commitment, and you can give them different purposes. You know, corporations have a duty to their shareholders to make as highest profit as possible within all legal means. Well, if you have a crown corporation, you could say, you know, here you are operating. You're actually trying to get people to buy less of this stuff, to conserve. You can change the whole mandate of it. 73% of Canadians wanted public ownership in Petro-Canada to continue. There was a poll done that 51% of Canadians supported nationalizing the oil companies. This is far to the left of the NDP. Even 34% of Albertans did that. The next one, Bolivia nationalizes oil and gas industry. And then actions for activists. Okay, stop new export pipelines, liquefied natural gas terminals, tar sands expansion, protest the Bush-Harper Calderon SPP. This is going to be near Ottawa on August 21st. Environmentalists, talk to them about proportionality. A lot of the environmental plans are good, but they don't talk about this energy relationship we have with the U.S. Lobbying, becoming a member of Parkland Institute. which is non-profit. Let me just finish off with how I finished my talk. No SPP before public hearings, bills before Parliament, consent of Canadians, no export of raw bitumen, no environmental sacrifice zones in northern Alberta, higher economic rents to the Norway level, a Mexican exemption and proportionality, and finally, a new SPP, a secure petroleum plan for Canada.